Anne Atkins, you're in the public eye for all the reasons that Bernard went through briefly there. Thought for the Day on Radio 4, novels, other books as well. There's a book on bringing up children. You were Agony Atkins for several years with the Daily Telegraph, and you write for a number of the national newspapers. I guess it's fair to say you're famous.
Do you know, Nick, there's a whole bunch of people over there and over there who are thinking, what is the Daily Telegraph and what on earth is Thought for the Day? I guess that nobody here under the age of 25 has ever heard of me.
Well, that might be true, but plenty of people over the age of 25 have heard of you. And you are in the public eye. I am telling you that.
Okay. I'm going to put this to the challenge. And if I win, you owe me a fiver, okay? Hands up, everybody. Okay, you're on my side on this, okay? Hands up, everybody who hadn't heard of me until 2 minutes ago. Right.
That's
a fiver, Nick. No? You owe me a big drink. For sure.
Well, we can argue about that afterwards. I think I had the whole of the main section.
Yeah, but I was only looking at the wings, right? Okay.
Well, my question is, did you think when so when you were their age?
Yeah. Had I heard of me?
As a teenager, no. When you were their age, did you think you would be famous among more elderly people?
So when I was a child, I was going to be properly famous, really famous, okay. Not Daily Telegraph, Today programme famous.
Okay, so it hasn't quite happened,
no,
has you?
No, I'm a failure.
I see. Okay.
It's very sad.
But you are able to make a contribution to the national debate through the papers and radio. How would you sum up what you're trying to contribute?
Which national debate is that?
Well, debates, national debates. Euthanasia has been in the news recently.
Okay.
That kind of thing.
What am I trying to contribute? the main thing I'm trying to contribute usually is enough money to feed my children by the end of the week. But what am I trying to contribute? I mean, actually, I say that frivolously, but that is... that is the main answer. I'm really a writer. You know, this is how I earn a living. Like, you might sweep the streets or pull teeth or, you know, I don't get up in the morning and think, what am I going to contribute to the national debate today? You know, so it's not as if I've got a sort of secret agenda that I just, you know, somebody rings me up and says, can you talk in 20 minutes' time for 5 minutes on Five Live on whatever? Actually, one of my sons... Alex says that when people ring me up and say, what is your view on euthanasia? My answer is always, what do you want my view on euthanasia to be? This is not quite true. But I'm not... So what I'm trying to say is every Christian in the workplace has this tension to a greater or lesser degree. I mean, if you're a Christian teacher... What is the message you're trying... Do you see what I mean? You're not trying to get out a particular message. You're trying to teach geography or whatever it might be. But if you're also a Christian, you have an even more important message that your whole life is about. Now, I'm much more concerned with that message in bringing up my children and being friends with my next-door neighbour than I am when I'm on the radio, because when I'm on the radio, I'm not going to change anybody's life. I'm really not, you know. I'm just providing 5 minutes of entertainment. And it's really in your everyday life with the people who live with you and see you all the time that Christianity makes a difference, not on the radio.
Hmm. Were you brought up in a Christian home?
Yeah. Yeah.
And at what point did you yourself come to believe what your parents believed?
Happened in two stages, but as I think about it, I was going to say, no, perhaps it happens in three stages, and then I realised, well, actually, it happens all the time. I think you're believing in a new way almost every day of your life. You learn to believe more, perhaps, in the way that in a relationship, in a marriage, you learn to love more every day. You know, you think when you first fall in love, you think, I'm in love. And, you know, 6 months later, you think, gosh, I'm really in love. And then, in our case, 30 years, I suppose these guys don't know what 30 years is, but in our case, 30 years later, you think, now I'm really, really in love. And I think it's similar with belief. You think, well, now, I really believe, because yesterday, or 5 years ago, or 10 years ago. So it has been a progression. So when I was a child, I believed because it was like the air we breathed in a Christian home. It was just, this is how the world is. You know, God was in our home in the way that oxygen was in our home. My parents, you know... my parents prayed. I knew they prayed. I mean, my mother prayed with me when she put me to bed, and my father prayed when he took me to chapel, and, you know, so I didn't even think about it as a child. Then as a teenager, it was much more of a sort of emotional commitment, I think. That I knew, in a sense, that you know something emotionally. You know your parents love you, or you know you like your best friend. And it was that kind of knowledge. And I can remember as a teenager having this sort of sense that it was the most real thing I knew was that Jesus is who he claimed to be. And then when I became a student, it was different again. Then it became an intellectual commitment. And I suppose that was when I looked at his claims objectively, as you might look at, you know, if somebody was trying to explain to you black holes in space or whatever, and you would look at the evidence and you would say, does this make sense and is this persuasive? And that was when I kind of looked at the historical evidence for Jesus being who he claimed to be. And so that was when I sort of made a commitment up here, if you like. But then in later years, you know, recently we've been through some very rough times, and then that's a different kind of belief altogether, because then you get to the point when you're so emotionally exhausted that you haven't got the energy left to believe anything. And that's when I kind of knew that my faith was nothing to do with me. It was just that God was hanging on to me, not that I was hanging on to God. So it's something that keeps growing and growing in different directions. And there's not one point at which you can say that is the... Actually, I was doing an evening like this some years ago. It was an all-women's evening, although that's not particularly relevant to this. But the questioner said to me... when did you become a Christian? And I said, well, I was brought up in a Christian home, you know. And she said, yeah, but when did you become a Christian? And I said, well, I don't know, because I was kind of brought up in a Christian home, you know. And she said, yeah, but when were you converted? I said, well, I don't know. And she said, yeah, but when did you personally walk from darkness into light to make Jesus yours and your own personal self? And I said, look, honestly, I'm sorry. I was brought up a Christian. I've always been a Christian as far as I know. And I could see this panic in her face. The speaker we've got tonight isn't a proper Christian. What am I going to do? So I'm not a proper Christian, Nick. I haven't got a great testimony or a conversion story. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine by me to grow up in a Christian home and to believe more and more as you go. But I can imagine quite a lot of people in Britain today, if they were hearing us, would say, well, you know, that's what happens when you grow up in Cambridge in Britain. But if you were growing up in Saudi Arabia, you'd be here talking about Muhammad and Islam. How would you respond to that?
If you were brought up in a certain kind of village in a remote part of, let's say, Namibia, okay? Actually, Namibia is probably the wrong example, but, you know, somewhere very remote, you might believe in voodoo rather than Western medicine, yeah? Mm-hmm. Would that have any bearing on which is a better way to treat your cancer? That's not a difficult question, Nick.
No. I'll take medicine.
You're with me? You take medicine.
Yeah.
Now, suppose somebody said to you, you only believe in Western medicine because you're brought up in the West. Does that make it any less valid? You sure?
Yes, sir. You're
very uncertain about this,
Nick.
You do believe in Western medicine.
I do,
okay. If I'd been brought up in other parts of the world, I might not have heard the gospel when I heard the gospel. If I'd been brought up in a different family. You know, next door to the family I was brought up in Cambridge. You know, I might not have become a Christian. I don't know. I don't know how the process works. I don't know why. I certainly don't know why Jesus chose me. I didn't do anything. You know, but I think that's perfectly possible. If I'd been brought up in a different culture, in a different country where the gospel isn't preached, heaven forbid, you know, I might not have heard the gospel and I might not be a Christian. But that doesn't make Christianity any less true. That doesn't make Jesus any less the person. Oh, has my microphone just gone off? Is it still working?
Yeah.
You sure?
Yeah, perfect. Let me try the question a slightly different way then. So sticking with your example of voodoo and Western medicine, my guess is if there was a Muslim person here from Saudi Arabia, they would say, oh, well, to use your example, we're the ones with Western medicine and you're the ones with voodoo, the Christian faith.
Yeah. Yeah, he might. She might. So what's your point?
Why is Christianity equal Western medicine? Why is it the reliable one, the true one, that we can trust and follow confidently?
Well, this comes back to, as I said, one of the stages in the development of my belief, if you like, was the moment at which I looked at the intellectual claims of Jesus. And I believe, I mean, don't take my word for this, okay, but this is the most important question that any of you will ever ask yourselves. Is Jesus Christ... Well, I think it's the most important. I mean, if he's not who he says he is, then it's not an important question. But if there's a little tiny chance that he might be, then Jesus is the answer to the biggest question any of us face, which is, what are we going to do the day we get run over by a car, or the day we get to the age of 95 and get whatever it is that finally bumps us off, or the day, you know... So... If there's any chance that Jesus' claims are true, this is the most important question we ever address. Now, I have been convinced by the objective evidence, the empty tomb, the evidence of those who knew him, what they believed happened, the amount they were prepared to go through for what they believed, it all points to me to the most plausible answer being Jesus being the Son of God and the man he claimed to be, and having the answers to life, death, the universe, and everything. But as I say, don't take my word for it. Look at the evidence. And if Islam has got better evidence, then the answer's clear. But I don't think it has. I could be wrong.
We've got lots of teenagers here this evening. What was hardest about following Jesus as a teenager?
Am I allowed to give the wrong answer?
yes, I think.
I don't think I've... I didn't actually find following Jesus hard as a teenager. You know, I get asked... Sometimes get asked questions... I was doing something a week or two ago, and beforehand the person who was interviewing me said, now I want to ask you about persecution of Christians in the workplace. And I was thinking, what? We live in, you know, England. There isn't persecution of Christians in the workplace. You know, there really isn't. Not compared with countries where there is real persecution of Christians. I compared with most of history and most of the world, it is actually very easy to be a Christian in this country. It really is. You know, what persecution do you and I face, Nick? We really don't compare with... Or perhaps you do, I don't know. But I don't. I mean, I've visited Christians in parts of the world where it is really tough to follow Jesus. You can't go to university, you can't get a decent job, you can't get decent accommodation. And some countries in the world, you lose your freedom. Sometimes you lose your life. We don't have that here. So I really can't say that it was difficult for me as a teenager, as a Christian. I mean, I think if I were a teenager now... becoming a Christian from not having been brought up as a Christian, probably, my guess, but these teenagers can tell me if I'm right or wrong, my guess, the hardest issue would be sex, probably. Because now the only people who are not, you know, over the age of 15 and under the age of 95 who are not, you know, having sex are people who've got a faith reason not to, not just Christians, but, you know, it's a tiny minority of the population. So my guess is that if I were a teenager now, becoming a Christian from not having been brought up one, I would find that quite a challenge. But I'm guessing. I don't know. Maybe it would be something else. I think it's much easier if you're brought up as a Christian, because then you've always had that expectation that you want to save sex for marriage. But I would think that would be quite a difficult one, but maybe not. I don't know.
You're now a mum with 5 children. There'll be plenty of mums here. And I imagine there'll be some mums here who are not following Jesus. Plenty, even more people here who grew up with a mother not following Jesus. Mm-hmm. What difference does it make to you as a mother to be following him?
That's a bit like saying, what difference does it make to you being a blonde, being a mother? You know, I've never tried it the other way. So, but I think the biggest difference, I mean, there are some spin-off benefits to being a Christian. And what I call spin-off benefit, I mean, going back to the sex question, for instance, I believe it is a spin-off benefit, and a terrific spin-off benefit, that we have the Christian teaching on sex, because it makes it a heck of a lot more fun. Because you save it up for one person, and then you have a really good time with that one person. Now, I think that's great. And I won't say any more about that, or I'll embarrass Sean. But it is, you know, that's terrific. That's a great benefit to being a Christian. And I am really, really glad that I'm a Christian for that one reason alone. But that's a spin-off benefit, right? Another spin-off benefit is that you tend to make relationships more important than maybe earning money or whatever. Not necessarily. I mean, there are people who are not Christians who make that same choices. But there tends to be, because Jesus puts such a high premium on relationships rather than other things, that when you follow him, you tend to put your value there. Now, that has another terrific spin-off benefit, that it's easier to stay married. So that it makes family life a lot more enjoyable and fun and easier, because your children know that you're likely to stick with each other, even if you go through rough times, and that is a huge benefit, but it's a spin-off. It's not the real benefit of Christianity. The real benefit of Christianity is the relationship with Jesus. That doesn't make any difference whether you're a mum or a, you know, whatever. So it's not really got anything to do with being a mother. The real difference that being a Christian makes to me is that one day I'm going to get to the end of my life, and instead of annihilation, I'm going to have the most terrific future with Jesus and all my friends, and it's going to be fantastic. That's the difference that being a Christian makes to me. Not being a mother, really.
It's a spin-off.
Yeah, I mean, any difference in our house because we're Christians is the spin-off. The real difference is a relationship with somebody who's going to get me through death into the most glorious, fantastic future. And, the real difference, I mean, this will be harder for the guys on the... Why do you have this sort of generational apartheid? It's really weird. I mean, I came along here and it said, reserved for youth. And I immediately thought, I want to sit there. Why am I not allowed to sit there? Anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yeah. Why do you have this? Why do you divide yourself up by ages?
Not my decision.
No, your decision. Okay. Okay. Right. Okay, I'll stop criticising you. I'm sorry. At least you don't divide the genders. You don't have men this side, women that... No. This will be harder for the teenagers to relate to, because this is kind of further off in the future, but... My parents came to live with us last summer, and to our great sorrow, my mother died just a few weeks after they moved in with us. Now, that is, you know, that's a milestone when you lose one of your parents. I know I will see my mother again. That makes so much difference. Oh, I mean, my father is in pieces. He really is. He is not coping at all with... He's lost himself, you know? He's lost... They were about to celebrate their 70th wedding anniversary. How fantastic is that? And he's lost himself. I mean, he is totally at a loss. But, you know, he says to me 2 or 3 times a week, we will see her again, won't we? I don't know how he would put one foot in front of the other without that. That's the difference Jesus makes. I'm going to see my mother again.
I expect a number of people would assume that because you're Christian with the Bible's values, those spin-offs, not the main thing, but the spin-offs, because you've been an agony aunt for a national newspaper, that if we entered the Atkins family home, it would be a bit like one of those 1950s TV commercials.
What, all in black and white? Yeah. We don't have any colour in our house.
A colour one, then. Where everything is perfect. Would we find that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm in a skirt in front of the Yaga with my hair in sort of, you know, and Sean comes home with a briefcase and says, "Hello, darling. You've seen our house, Nick. We're like that, aren't we? The girls all in little smock dresses and the boys in..." What are you asking me? I don't know where this question is going.
How do you handle the expectation that people must have that your life and your family is going to be perfectly smooth and successful and happy?
I don't think people have that expectation, actually. I mean, when I started work as an agony aunt for the Daily Telegraph, the Daily Telegraph is a newspaper for really old people. When I started writing for the Daily Telegraph, one of the journalists, Cassandra Jardine, who I knew from Footlights days, which... have people here heard of Footlights? There's a town called Cambridge, which is... What direction is that in?
East.
Well, anyway, somewhere. Anyhow, I digress. She came to interview me to launch my column, and she said, "Tell me all the problems you've had." She said, "Agony aunts have to have a load of problems, because otherwise you don't have any credibility as an agony aunt." So she was certainly not expecting it to be... perfect. And actually, funnily enough, the irony of it is, that was 12 years ago, and I can remember this conversation I had with Cassandra. I said, "Look, we really have, I'm at a loss, because we are really, really happy. Well, I don't think we've ever faced a real problem, you know, that I would call a real problem. We've just been extraordinarily fortunate." And in fact, because she's a very good journalist, she sort of dug and dug and dug, and, you know, eventually I remembered that I'd had some miscarriages and Sean had had Emmy and various things like that. But basically, we were very, very happy, fortunate people. Now, within months, one of our children had nearly killed himself and then was diagnosed with a disability, and then one of our other children went missing for 48 hours and was all over the national newspapers, and... We eventually discovered had another disability, and we had 10, 12 years of the most horrendous... Then we were homeless for nearly a year. And we've had the most ghastly, horrible, horrible, horrible 12 years, which we only really just came out of last year. So I'm not quite sure what was behind your question, but we certainly, you know, from having been so happy, we didn't know why we were so happy. We then went through one thing after another... Which, I mean, quite a lot of my friends said, "Gosh, just one of these things would have knocked most families in pieces." And you've had three major things in 10 years.
If there are people listening tonight who can relate to that and, you know, are going through terrible trials like those themselves, and...
Or worse. I mean, people go through a lot worse than we've been through. Mm.
And if, as I'm guessing is likely... Some of those people are not following Jesus. What would you say to them in particular about following Jesus? How has he helped you to get through those trials?
Well, he doesn't solve the problems, right? That is an absolute fallacy. You know, come to Jesus and your debts will be cleared. No. Come to Jesus and I don't know. I mean, you hear all sorts of bizarre things. I once heard an evangelist say, "Come to Jesus and your children will suddenly become, you know, wonderfully obedient children." I mean, it wasn't quite as crude as that, but no, absolutely. Jesus is not a panacea. He's a friend. And when you're going through a rough time, it's great to have friends alongside you. We had three or four awful, awful, awful years in Oxfordshire. And we ended up living in a little village called Horsepath, which is just outside Oxford. And we were living in a cottage called Manor Cottage, and we were actually in the estate of the Manor House, which is a gorgeous house. We were in this tiny, tiny little cottage, seven of us. And in the Manor House, they had all this... Actually, there were five of them, to be fair. But They became very, very good friends of ours, really close friends, and we were 20 yards from each other, and we were in each other's house in and out all the time. Now, our lives just got worse and worse and worse. They couldn't take those problems away for us, these friends of ours, but they were always there for us. And, you know, we could ring them up, we could go around at midnight, and they would give us a gin and tonic and a, you know, whatever it might be. That was terrific. It didn't take the problems away, but boys, was it good to have good friends like that. Now, Jesus doesn't take, you know, he doesn't take those problems away. I was on a television program last year, and it was a program called The Big Questions, which goes out on a Sunday morning, and they take sort of three questions one after another, and you discuss this. It's not a sort of program I would ever watch, but I sometimes appear on it. And one of the three questions that morning was prayer. What does prayer do? Okay? And they had some Christians planted in the audience to say, oh, you know, prayer completely transforms your life. And there was two lots. And one of them, she terribly much wanted to meet the Pope or something. And she prayed, and lo and behold, she met the Pope. Fine. And there was another one who very much needed somewhere to live. And she said, I wouldn't qualify for council housing because I'm single and I haven't got any children. And I prayed and somebody gave me £20,000. Great. We have five children. We prayed and nobody provided £20,000. Nora has nothing. You know, what does this say to people who've been through the Holocaust? Do we think 6 million Jews won't pray? I mean, what does this say to people who you know, somebody's sitting at home watching whose child is dying of leukemia? What are we saying? That God answers me but not you? God doesn't answer these prayers that we can see in a way that we want, necessarily. The promise is not a rose garden. The promise is that I am there for you and I will get you through the last, final, worst trial of all, which is death. That's the promise. And he can lead us through a really rough time on the way. And I don't know why. But he doesn't ever say... You know, he says, I will go through the valley of the shadow of death with you, but not that I'm, you know, going to take that pain away.
Thank you very much, Anne Atkins, for coming to be with us this evening. So we begin with a short prayer. If we could all bow our heads and I'll lead us in a short prayer for God's help. Thank you. Lord God, we pray that you would open our eyes that we might see the truth. In Jesus' name, amen. Anne was talking just to the end there about the greatest trial that we face, the trial of death. Wouldn't you agree? We tend to sort of push death out of our thinking. We generally refuse to let thoughts of our own future death into our thinking. When I was at Bible college in Durham, I once had to go on a group visit to a funeral parlour. We went to a small family-owned undertaker's, and the director told us about his daily trade. I remember him saying there's a direct link between the local death rate and his income for that year, which is sort of obvious when you think about it, but I'd never thought about it like that before. While he was talking to us, I found I couldn't take my eyes off a coffin in the middle of the room. It was an empty coffin. But the thought struck me as if I'd never thought it before. That one day I was going to end up in one of those myself. Flat, horizontal. And while everyone else around me, the people around the coffin, would have a heart that was warm and beating like normal, my heart there in that coffin would be stone cold and still. I shut death out of my thinking normally. As I said, I think that's something we all do. And it took the sight of that coffin 3 paces away to stir up those very powerful thoughts of my own future death. Well, this evening, I want to stir up thoughts of death. In fact, can I gently ask you to think about your own future death, which could happen at any time? Because according to the Bible, Jesus can get a person through death, through the soil and the worms, and up and out the other side. You should have on your seat a copy of John, it'll say on the front, John's biography of Jesus. It's lifted straight out of the Bible, it's pure Bible, and it's the best way to find out who Jesus is, what he says, what he did, the difference he makes, to look at this eyewitness biography. And we're going to be doing quite a lot of that this evening, looking into this book lifted straight from the Bible. And if you could turn, please, to page number 32. And when we're all there, I'll read sentences 25 and 26, just about a third of the way down page 33. So page 33, and I'll read sentence 25 and 26. Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live, even though he dies, and whoever lives and believes in me will never die." They're breathtaking sentences. They are jaw-dropping sentences. I think it's a good use of our time this evening to examine those extraordinary sentences from every angle, because Jesus is saying he's got the answer, the solution to death. We've got to give that phenomenal claim a fair hearing. So let's get the background on these sentences. Why does Jesus say these things? Who's he talking to? Let me give you the lowdown on the person Jesus says these things to. She's called Martha. We know from another part of the Bible that she's a very practical woman who loves to be hard at work doing things for other people. She spends much of her time with her sleeves rolled up above her elbows. This is a woman who can't see dust on a windowsill without instinctively looking round for a cloth so that she can wipe it away. Martha is someone who, if she catches sight of a sink full of dirty dishes at a friend's house, give her half a chance, and she's in there. In goes the washing up liquid, on go the marigolds. And before too long, all the dishes are gleaming. So's the whole kitchen, because she scrubs down the worktops, all those breadcrumbs, throws away the out-of-date food, and while she's at it, she gives the floor a good mop. She's a no-nonsense kind of person, a hard-working and helpful person. I'm sure people often said, where would we be without Martha? Everything would fall to pieces without her. And yet, in spite of all that, as we'll see, Jesus is deeply concerned about Martha. He is anxious about her because she is not ready for the greatest trial, the trial that Anne was talking about earlier, the trial of death. Let's find out why that is. It will help us to get more of a handle on those two extraordinary sentences that we looked at just now, the ones I read. Let's look at the conversation Jesus has with this woman, Martha. It's an ongoing conversation spread out over three scenes. Scene one begins when Martha and her sister Mary send a message to Jesus. And the title I'm giving scene one is an urgent letter. An urgent letter. Let's look down at sentence one on page 32. Now, a man named Lazarus was sick. He was from Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. This Mary, whose brother Lazarus now lay sick, was the same one who poured perfume on the Lord and wiped his feet with her hair. So the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Lord, the one you love is sick." Lord, the one you love is sick. That's a polite way of saying, please, Jesus, we need your help. Come quickly. Get yourself over here. And we get Jesus' reaction in sentences 5 and 6 on page 32. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. Yet when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed where he was 2 more days. First sight, it doesn't seem to make any sense at all. Why does Jesus wait for an extra 2 days? Surely if he loves Lazarus, like John says he does, he'd hurry to the sick bed. Well, sentence 4 explains the delay. When he heard this, Jesus said, "This sickness will not end in death. No, it is for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it." Throughout John's book, Jesus gets glorified whenever he does a sign which shows everyone that he really must be God's Son. So in sentence 4, Jesus is saying, there's another one of these signs on the way. And he says the same kind of thing a bit further down the page in sentences 14 and 15. "So then he told them plainly, 'Lazarus is dead. And for your sake, I'm glad I was not there, so that you may believe.'" So let's piece all of this together. Jesus chooses to stay where he is so that Lazarus's sick bed will become his deathbed, because that will set things up for him to do something so glorious that it will point like a signpost to his godness. It will show people like Martha that Jesus really is the Son of God, who offers people life beyond the grave. Let's move on to scene 2 of this 3-scene conversation between Jesus and Martha. Scene 2 is an upset lady. An upset lady. And I'll read from sentence 17. "On his arrival, Jesus found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. Bethany was less than 2 miles from Jerusalem, and many Jews had come to Martha and Mary to comfort them in the loss of their brother. When Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went out to meet him." Martha has gone out to meet Jesus after hearing that finally he's arrived in town. And she says in sentence 21, I imagine her marching out like a battleship to meet him, "Lord," Martha said to Jesus, "if you had been here, my brother would not have died." Do you catch the disappointment? I'm slightly cranking it up. But it's there, isn't it, in the sentence, the disappointment, the frustration in what she says to Jesus. Remember, she knows when that urgent letter was sent to him. She knows where she sent the letter. She'd have put 2 and 2 together and come to the view that Jesus has been lounging around where he was instead of coming straight over. And she's not impressed. "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." She's still giving him a hard time in sentence 22, the next one, when she says, "But I know that even now, God will give you whatever you ask." Well, that tells us a lot about Martha and what she thinks of Jesus. "Even now, God will give you whatever you ask." She's giving away that she doesn't think Jesus is the Son of God. Jesus is far bigger than "even now, God will give you whatever you ask." From the very first line of John's eyewitness biography of Jesus, it's clear that Jesus claims to be God and that he is God, the Son of God, God sent down from God. But Martha doesn't see it like that. The closest she gets is to say that Jesus has special access to God. "Even now," she says, "God will give you whatever you ask." That's not good enough. The penny hasn't dropped with Martha. She can't see who Jesus really is. It's as if she's wearing a veil over her face. And as she looks at Jesus, she just doesn't see him clearly because the veil's there. She doesn't see that he is God come down into our world. Well, let's carry on listening in to their conversation. I'll read over on page 33, sentences 23 and 24. Jesus said to her, Your brother will rise again. Martha answered, I know. He will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Well, those were normal words of comfort among Jewish people back then. They knew from the Bible that a day was coming when all the dead would rise again to face God. And they called that future rising event the resurrection. So what Jesus and Martha say to each other there, it's what we'd expect them to say, really. Your brother will rise again. I know. He will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. But what Jesus says next is incredibly unusual, unexpected. And I long for these stunning words, which we've already looked at, I long for them just to ring in our ears and to keep on ringing in your ears as you leave here tonight, as you go back home, as you wake up tomorrow morning, all the way until a bip, bip, bip becomes a beep and a doctor closes your eyes. And after a while, a nurse ties a tag to your toe. Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. And whoever lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? Remember, I said the Jewish people believed a day would come when all the dead would rise up to face God. The day of resurrection. Well, look at what Jesus does with that in sentence 25. He pulls it into himself. Jesus says, I am the resurrection. He said, I am that future event. In other words, rising from the dead happens when someone meets Jesus and puts their trust in him, because he gives life. He offers life. People who accept that offer, who say yes to it, receive life from him. What he offers is real life. It begins now and goes on beyond the grave. When Jesus says, I am the resurrection, we shouldn't think he's pouring cold water on that future day of resurrection. Earlier on in this same book, Jesus himself says that a future day is coming when physically dead people will all be raised up for judgment, leading to eternal life or God's punishment. But what Jesus is trying to get across here is that eternal life begins for the believer before that future day of rising from the dead. Jesus says people come alive to God through him. And that's an unbreakable relationship. We were hearing about that relationship from Anne. And Jesus says that's an unbreakable relationship that goes on forever. And that was how it happened with me. I can remember when I came alive to God. Beforehand, I never really paid him much attention. If you'd said to me, aged 14, do you know God yourself? I'd have said, do I know God? No, I can't say that I do. It's a weird question. That's what I'd have said. I was dead to God, dead to him. And then I found my way to the Christian meeting at my school, and I heard about Jesus. As I listened, I saw he really is who he says he is, which is not rocket science. Just, it's very straightforward. It happened to me as I was listening to this talk. He is who he says he is. Really straightforward. But everything changed from that point on. I didn't get any flashing lights. I certainly didn't hear choirs of angels in the background. But from that point on, I knew Jesus. I knew him as the Son of God. He is who he says he is. Through Jesus, I came alive to God. And if you ask me now, do you know God? I say, yes, I really do. And we heard Anne saying, yes, she really does know God for herself. And the reason why knowing God matters so much is because anyone who comes alive to God through Jesus has their judgment day verdict settled in advance. Let me try to illustrate what Jesus is saying here. I've watched a number of my friends go through the whole business of getting married. It's an interesting process to observe from a safe distance. First of all, a friend of mine will start going out with someone. And that's pretty interesting, that stage. Then they'll get engaged. Then there's the marriage ceremony. So it seems to me there's a three-stage process, as I've observed. Going out, engagement, marriage. Well, as I've watched this process, it's occurred to me that the crunch part is, generally speaking, the proposal, the going down on one knee, the engagement, rather than the actual wedding ceremony. What I mean is, by the time of the wedding, by the time of the actual marriage, it's all a foregone conclusion. Everyone knows what's going to happen, unless it's a film. But in real life, everyone knows what's going to happen. But at the point of the engagement, there is a lot of doubt in the air. The girl is thinking, well, is he going to ask me to marry him? You know, maybe he's never going to get round to ask me. What is his problem? Why is he being such a complete lump and not asking me to marry him? And the guy is there thinking, oh, do I really want to marry her? That's a big step to take. Maybe she's not the right girl for me after all. There's a lot of doubt in the air. A friend of mine called Nick, another Nick, took his girlfriend Kate for a long walk around some beautiful landscaped gardens in Dorset called Stour Head. And she had picked up the impression that this was going to be the weekend when he asked her to marry him, when he finally popped the question. But Nick told me that all the way round Stour Head, he told me later, all the way round Stour Head, he was thinking, I'm not there yet in my head. I can't ask her to marry me. I can't propose yet. I'm just not quite ready yet in my head. Well, as they turned for home, and Kate realized he still hadn't asked her to marry him, she burst into tears. And he didn't know what to say. He didn't know how to comfort her because he knew why she was crying. But he couldn't really comfort her because that would be the only way to do that would be to ask her to marry him there and then. He wasn't ready yet in his head. The following morning, he suggested they should go to Stour Head again. And she said, okay. And this time round, he did ask her to marry him. And she said yes, and then he got out some champagne and a couple of glasses from where he'd hidden them in his bag. And when he looked up from pouring the champagne, Kate was nowhere to be seen because she'd gone up a hill to try to get some reception on her mobile so she could text all her friends. Anyway, when it came to the day of the marriage itself, there was no bursting into tears. There was no coming back the next day. There was none of that drama at all. I was a guest at the wedding day, and I saw how everything went very smoothly because the crunch part of the process for them was back when they got engaged in those gardens. All those I do's were a foregone conclusion because the outcome had been settled at the point of their engagement. Well, I hope you see what that story has in common with what Jesus says here. He's saying you can settle the judgment day verdict long before that future day comes. If you trust in me as the Son of God, Jesus says to Martha, if you come alive to God through me, Jesus says, then you'll be an undiable person. It's not a word, I know, but it should be because that's what happens to you if you believe in Jesus. You become undiable. Just look at how small and insignificant death is for the believer in sentences 25 and 26. It's still there. It's still there. But look at how small and insignificant it is. I am the resurrection and the life, Jesus says. He who believes in me will live even though he dies. There's death. But how small and insignificant. Whoever lives and believes in me will never die. When I think back to that time in the funeral parlor in Durham, death seemed like such a big thing as I was looking at that empty wooden coffin in the middle of the room. And of course, there is a sense in which it is a very big thing. We were hearing of the impact on Anne's father, his wife's death. But for the believer, there is a very real sense in which death is not a big thing at all. And we heard that as well from Anne about her father and his hope. Well, doesn't that rock you to the core, this very real sense in which death is not a big thing? It should rock us to the core. Whoever believes in me, Jesus says, will never die. The words of Jesus. There's one more scene to come, one last scene in this conversation between Jesus and Martha. Scene 3, an unexpected liberation. It happens right in front of the tomb where Lazarus has been laid. I'll read from sentence 38. That's over on page 34. Jesus, once more deeply moved, came to the tomb. It was a cave with a stone laid across the entrance. "Take away the stone," he said. "But Lord," said Martha, the sister of the dead man, "by this time there is a bad odor, for he's been there 4 days. Then Jesus said, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" The middle of sentence 39, that's classic Martha, isn't it? If you remember that character sketch I gave you earlier, this is Martha in her usual homemaking, washing up the dishes frame of mind. "But Lord, by this time there is a bad odor. He's been there 4 days. I'd advise you not to open up the tomb and let out that odor." But it's also another example of Martha failing to trust in Jesus as the Son of God. She just doesn't trust that he knows what he's doing. She may say back in sentence 27 that he's the Christ, the God King promised by the prophets, the Jewish prophets. She may say that, but in reality, no. Jesus isn't her all-powerful God. She doesn't trust him to know what's best. Here's a woman who claims to be a Christian. That's her claim. She claims to believe in Jesus. She can say some of the right things. "I believe you are the Christ, the Son of God, who was to come into the world." That's what she says. But she doesn't really believe in Jesus in her heart. She doesn't know him as her God in her experience of life. She hasn't come alive to his godness. Jesus says in reply in sentence 40, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" He wants her to believe. He's saying, "Look, Martha, if you really believed in me, you would see my glorious godness." He's saying, "You would know that I can do glorious God things, like bringing a corpse back to life." So they took away the stone. It's verse 41. I'll drop down to sentence 43. When he had said this, Jesus called in a loud voice, "Lazarus, come out." Imagine being Lazarus at this point in time. Just try to imagine that. There you are, lying in the cool of the tomb, except, well, you're not aware that it's cool, because at this point in time, you are dead. And then you hear your name being called out. "Lazarus, come out." So that's the first thing you're conscious of. Your name is being called. And I'm sure the next thing to go through your mind is, oh, what a terrible smell. I hope that's not me. That's what I always think if I smell something bad. Am I responsible? What? You're back in the tomb. Keep imagining, please, that you are Lazarus. Lazarus, you struggle to your feet to head towards that voice and away from that smell. There's some kind of cloth around your head and more cloth around your body, but you can't take it off because your arms are sort of strapped in by these cloths. Then you feel someone's hand taking the head covering away. So daylight bursts into your vision. And when your eyes finally get used to the sunshine, you see a crowd of people in front of you. And everyone, with the exception of Jesus, is looking at you like this. And I wish YouTube had been around to record that. Not because I need that to help me believe the miracle. No, I believe John's testimony. I would just love to have seen the expressions on the faces of the people there in that crowd watching, and Jesus there among them with a completely different expression on his face. And those people are watching a dead man come back after 4 days rotting in a tomb. But we mustn't focus too much on this miracle, because a really important resurrection going on here isn't Lazarus. No, it's the people in sentence 45. Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him, trusted in him, believed in him. It's true. Lazarus gets a new lease of physical life, but he'll die. He'll die again when the time comes. But the people in sentence 45 are putting their trust in Jesus. And we know what happens when people do that. Jesus says, whoever believes in me will never die. Was Martha herself, one of those people in sentence 45, finally putting her trust in Jesus in a heart-rooted way? We're not told. It's a tantalizing question. We're not told whether she was one of them. But I hope the way forward is clear for any modern-day Marthas among us. And there may be some here this evening. You know, like her, you're respectable. And you love doing things for other people. You are a helpful person. Practical person. You get things done. Perhaps you think of yourself as a Christian, like she did. But like Martha, Jesus just isn't God for you in your day-to-day experience of life. You couldn't say you're thrilled with his godness. You couldn't say you know him as your God or trust him as your God. He's an asteroid outside your personal solar system. He's not the blazing sun which everything else in your life orbits around. There'll be many people here who are thinking, as I say that, Jesus is, he is the sun in my life. Yes, things orbit around him. Not always, perhaps quite as they should, but he is the sun in my life, and other things orbit around him. And there'll be others thinking, no, that really doesn't fit with my experience of life. Yeah, it's more that he's an asteroid outside my personal solar system. Well, if that's you, the second group, I'm so pleased that you're here this evening, because it gives me the chance to call on you to open your eyes to Jesus and his godness. After he was killed, after he was buried, He was raised from the dead in a different way, never to die again. And the evidence of history puts that beyond doubt. Anne was talking about that earlier. It underlines his godness, the evidence for his resurrection from the dead. Please open your eyes to Jesus. Where do you stand with him? Do you know him as your God? Are you following him? Wouldn't this be a good time for you to come alive to the godness of Jesus, if that hasn't happened with you yet? He offers the forgiveness that we need for a fresh start with God. He does that through his agonizing death, pinned naked to a wooden cross, soaked in his own blood. That was his death. On that day, Jesus was punished by God in the place of his people. He went forward and said to God, "I'll take the punishment in their place. I'm willing." And that's what happened on that day of his death. He took the punishment in the place of his people. So his people no longer face God's punishment. They have forgiveness, a new relationship with God. You might be thinking, well, why do we need forgiveness from God? I'm a nice person. Martha sounds like a nice person. Why do we need forgiveness? Well, because in practice, we all give in, even the Marthas. We all give in to the human habit of ignoring God. We don't let him stay center stage. We elbow him out of our lives. And sometimes people think that doesn't matter. They think their good deeds will be enough to please God, even if they've never paid him a great deal of attention. But it's not like that, because the Bible says if you keep God out of your life, if he's not fully involved, then nothing else going on in your life can please him. It's like parents with a runaway teenager. Nothing that teenager does while he's on the run can please his parents, if you think about it, until their boy comes home. He might do various good deeds, I don't know, while he's on the run, but that's not going to please his parents until he comes home, until they have their boy home. And it's the same with God. Nothing that we do pleases him until we come home to him. Well, why don't you come home to God? Even this evening, Jesus offers us the power we need to live with him as God. Living life the Bible way. Anyone here today could become a true believer in Jesus as God's son. The offer is open to everyone. Wouldn't this be a good time for you to do that? It's the kind of thing that is so serious that if you know you are ready, you shouldn't put it off. And I love helping people to make a start with Jesus as their God. So what I thought I could do now is to pray a prayer as if I was coming alive to God through Jesus myself now. Happened with me about 18 years ago. But I'll pray as if it's all beginning now, to allow you to kind of hitch a ride on my prayer and use the words of my prayer yourself to say to God, you want to follow Jesus. You recognize him as the Son of God. There's no need to pray out loud. You can just pray silently in your own heart. But if you want to say those things to God, that you want to start following Jesus as his son, then please make the words of my prayer your own as I pray. So if we could all bow our heads now to give those people who want to pray the chance, and I'll lead us. Father God, I admit that I have elbowed you out of my life so often, but I believe that Jesus is your son, and through his death on the cross and resurrection from the dead, I can be forgiven and live forever. So I now come to him to follow him as the Son of God from this day forward. Well, shall we look up there? If you have just prayed that prayer, it's something that needs to be said to others. It's the best decision you've ever made. This is the best day of your life. It's just happened. This is it. So please do tell someone. You could come and tell me. Perhaps if you've been brought by a Christian friend, you could tell them.